I want you to picture something for a second. Close your eyes. Well, unless you're driving, of course.
Yeah, please keep your eyes on the road if you're in the car.
Right, exactly. But if you can, imagine you are standing at the top of a 70-foot-tall hill. And it's not a grassy hill. It is a sheer, solid block of ice.
Which is terrifying.
Totally terrifying. Built on this massive wooden frame in the freezing cold of 17th century Russia, you sit down on a simple wooden sled, and I'm talking no seatbelts, no harness, nothing.
Just you and a piece of wood?
Yeah, and you launch yourself down a 50-degree drop, essentially just trusting gravity and, hoping for the best.
It's wild to think about, especially when you compare that mental image to like strapping into an aerodynamic 600-foot-tall marvel of modern steel today.
Oh, for sure.
Hurtling through the desert sky at over 150 miles per hour, locked to a track with absolute millimeter precision.
The contrast there is just staggering. But the core human desire, that need for a thrill, is exactly the same. So today, we're doing a deep dive into the most fascinating secrets from this massive stack of engineering and historical data we've got.
There's a lot of data here.
There is. We're going to figure out how we safely manipulate gravity to satisfy that adrenaline addiction. We're going to luxuriate in the details for the next 20 or 25 minutes, from the crazy origins to the mechanical safety secrets to the modern coaster wars. Okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even begin with the concept of a design thrill ride?
We actually have to look directly at those 17th century ice slides you just mentioned.
Really? That's the start.
Yeah, they were literally called Russian mountains, first appearing in the 1600s around St. Petersburg.
I just can't get over the lack of safety with those. Like, I'm comparing these original Russian ice slides to modern extreme winter sports, right? Even Olympic luge or skeleton athletes, they have incredibly specialized gear and highly engineered tracks to manage the physics. Dropping down a 50-degree ice slope on what is essentially a wooden plank sound like absolute madness.
It was definitely extreme, I mean, no question, yet it was massively popular. By the late 1700s, Catherine the Great actually had a summer version built in the gardens of her palace.
Wait, a summer version? How does that work without ice?
Well, instead of ice, they used wheeled trolleys, and these trolleys were secured in steel grooves that were mounted on wooden trails.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it used inertia to carry riders over a series of five hills in a single run. But the real mechanical leap, the one that changed everything, happened in France around 1817.
Because I imagine ice and, simple grooves can really only take you so far before friction or just a bad bounce throws you completely off the path.
Exactly. The French realized that
Yeah.
pretty quickly. So they built two early coasters, and one of them was famously called Les Montagnes de Belleville.
Which means the Russian mountains of Belleville. Great.
Spot on. And the huge innovation here was locking the vehicle to the path. The wheels were attached to carriages and actively locked onto the tracks with guide rails.
Okay, so that's the game changer.
Right, because this architectural shift allowed for much higher speeds and steeper hills. You could push the limits without the cart just flying off into the Parisian countryside.
I love how they kept the name too, Russian Mountains.
Actually, that leads to a fantastic linguistic paradox that survived into the modern day.
Oh, do tell.
In most Romance languages right now, roller coasters are still literally called Russian mountains. Like in French, it's montagnes russes.
Right.
But in Russia today, if you want to ride a roller coaster, you call them Amerikansky Gorky.
Wait, really?
Yeah, which translates directly to American Hills.
That's hilarious. They're just passing the buck back and forth. Like, no, these crazy things are your idea.
It's a perfect cultural exchange of adrenaline, really. But the Russian term American Hills makes a lot of sense historically, because America is where the concept truly evolved into a massive commercial industry.
How so?
Well, in 1827, a mining company in Pennsylvania built the Mauch-Chunk Switchback Railway.
So like a downhill gravity railroad.
Exactly. But it was originally designed purely for utility. It was just a cheap, efficient way to use gravity to deliver coal down a mountain.
Okay.
But by the 1850s, someone realized that, hey, sending people down the mountain is highly profitable. It became known as the Gravity Road, and thrill seekers would actually pay to ride it.
That's the ultimate pivot right there, going from industrial coal transport to selling adrenaline.
And that specific pivot sparked an idea for a man named Lamarcus Adna Thompson. In 1884, he opened the Gravity Switchback Railway at Coney Island in New York.
The famous Coney Island.
Exactly. Passengers would ride this bench-like car down a 600-foot track, and then the car would literally be switched over to a return track for the trip back.
Oh, I see.
And by the following year, another inventor introduced the first full-circuit coaster with a lift hill. And from there, the amusement park industry just exploded.
So we've gone from gravity-powered sleds to these massive closed loops. And here's where it gets really interesting, at least for me, because there is no engine on the roller coaster train itself.
Right, no engine at all.
The ride is a completely closed energy system from the moment it drops. It's like a slowly pulling back a giant rubber band as you go up the lift hill. You're building all that potential energy.
That's a great way to think about it.
And then the drop is simply letting the rubber band snap. You're just converting it to kinetic energy to carry the train through the rest of the track.
Precisely. And as a ride designer, you are entirely at the mercy of physics from that peak onward. You aren't just calculating a perfect kinetic run. You are actually managing a constant, unavoidable loss of mechanical energy.
Right, because of friction.
Yeah, every single foot of track steals a little bit of energy through the friction of the wheels and, of course, aerodynamic drag.
Because it's essentially fighting the wind the whole time. So you have to calculate the margins of error, right? What happens in a valleying scenario where, say, cold wheel grease or an unexpected headwind robs the train of, like, 5% of its momentum?
That's the nightmare scenario for an operator. If the train loses too much momentum, it won't clear the apex of the next hill.
No.
It'll simply roll backward and settle in the lowest point of the track, which we call the valley.
Hence the term valleying.
Exactly. So to prevent this, every subsequent hill has to be meticulously mathematically modeled to be shorter than the last one, accounting for harsh atmospheric conditions.
Makes sense.
Sometimes, engineers even install automated trim brakes on the track to lightly scrub off speed if a heavy train with a tailwind is running too fast. They have to ensure it hits the next element at the exact right velocity.
But I mean, calculating kinetic energy is completely useless if the train just flies off the track at the bottom of the first drop.
Very true.
How are modern wheels gripping the track differently than those 1817 Parisian carts to handle these intense speeds?
The secret to modern extreme layouts lies in a highly specialized three-wheel assembly made of polyurethane.
Polyurethane?
Yeah. It's used because it can withstand massive heat buildup without melting or losing its grip. Every single point of contact on a modern roller coaster train utilizes three types of wheels simultaneously. First, you have the road wheels. These sit directly on top of the tubular track, and they carry the physical weight of the train.
Okay, so that's your standard driving wheel.
Right. Then you have the side friction wheels.
Mm-hmm.
These ride on the inside or the outside edges of the track. They hug the rails horizontally, fundamentally preventing lateral derailment during those high-speed, tight turns.
Okay, so that covers up and sideways. But what about when the track turns you completely upside down, like in a loop?
That is the job of the third set, which are the upstop wheels.
Upstop wheels?
Yes. These are positioned entirely underneath the track rail. They actively prevent the train from lifting off the track during negative G-forces or inversions. So the track is literally trapped inside this three-wheel grip. It cannot escape the assembly.
That is wild. So the train is physically locked to the steel pipe, but that raises a pretty big issue when you think about it. What about the squishy humans sitting inside the train? Because engineers aren't just designing a vehicle, right? They are engineering around strict human biological limits.
This raises an important question, actually, about how much we can safely take. The human body can only withstand so much mechanical stress. Designers have very strict, exact G-force targets they must hit, and these are categorized into positive and negative Gs.
Right.
Positive G-force is acceleration that increases the feeling of your own weight. It physically pushes you down into your seat.
Like when you hit the bottom of a huge drop?
Exactly. If you're pulling two Gs, you feel like you weigh twice as much as you normally do. Designers typically establish a maximum limit of 4 to 6 positive Gs on a ride.
Wow, 6 Gs is like, that's fighter pilot territory.
It really is.
Sustaining that kind of pressure means blood gets physically pushed out of your head and pools in your lower body. That leads to what they call a gray out, where your vision narrows and loses color, or even a full blackout.
Which is why engineers design the track curves to apply those extreme forces for only fractions of a second. The curve radiuses are carefully widened at the bottom of drops, so the positive Gs spike and then immediately release.
Ah, so your body can recover.
Exactly. It allows your cardiovascular system to catch up.
So that's positive Gs. And what about negative Gs?
Negative G-force is the exact opposite. That's the sensation of weightlessness, where you feel like you're being lifted up and out of your seat. Roller coaster enthusiasts call this airtime.
Everyone loves airtime.
They do. Mm-hmm. But the target limit for negative Gs is much tighter, usually around 1.5 to 2 Gs as an absolute maximum.
Right, because our bodies are simply not built to handle blood rushing up into our heads, which is what happens under extreme negative Gs. I read that it causes a readout where the blood vessels in your eyes can actually burst.
Yeah, which is incredibly dangerous. Our physiology naturally fights gravity by pumping blood up to the brain all day long. So when gravity reverses, the body just overloads.
Okay, let me push back on this a little bit, thinking about those negative Gs lifting us out of our seats.
Sure.
Why is it that some of the most intense new coasters, rides that turn you completely upside down multiple times, why do they only use lap bars?
Oh, I know what you're getting.
It feels completely counterintuitive. Shouldn't a ride with a massive loop have a massive over-the-shoulder harness? Doesn't a lap bar seem inherently dangerous?
It's a common fear, but this really gets into the difference between psychological safety and physical safety.
Okay, explain that.
From a pure engineering standpoint, a properly locked lap bar combined with the bucket shape of the modern seat completely immobilizes your pelvis and upper legs. You are physically trapped in that seat.
So you're not going anywhere.
You cannot fall out, even if the train stalls while hanging completely upside down.
Wow, but the over-the-shoulder restraints just feel so much safer to an anxious rider. Like it's a hug from the machine.
They offer incredible peace of mind, no doubt. But those bulky over-the-shoulder harnesses have major physical drawbacks. During quick, snappy track transitions, your head can violently bounce back and forth between the hard restraints.
Oh, the dreaded headbanging effect. I've definitely experienced that on older steel coasters.
We all have. By transitioning to lap bars, designers eliminate headbanging entirely. They give you a much more open, freeing experience while keeping you 100% physically secure.
That makes a lot of sense. And speaking of feeling secure, I want to demystify another really memorable detail from the sources.
What's that?
We all know that terrifying, methodical click, 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 click sound as the train slowly climbs the initial lift hill. It builds incredible suspense, but it's actually an active mechanical failsafe, isn't it?
Yes. That clicking is the sound of the anti-rollback system doing its job.
It's not just to scare us.
Not at all. Underneath the train is a heavy metal pawl, often called a dog. As the train is pulled up by the chain, this dog drags over a series of toothed metal bumps bolted directly to the lift hill.
Okay.
If the chain were to suddenly snap or the massive lift motor failed, that metal dog would instantly drop into the teeth of the track, stopping the train from rolling backward. So every single click you hear is the failsafe engaging and disengaging.
It's not a sound of impending doom. It's the sound of engineering wrapping its arms around you.
Exactly.
But what about once you're freely coasting on the track? You've got a system that prevents backward crashes. You've got trains locked to the track. Forces are perfectly balanced. How do they prevent rear-end collisions with multiple trains running the circuit at the same time?
That is managed by the block system, which is controlled by the ride's programmable logic controller, or PLC. The computer divides the entire track into invisible zones, which we call blocks.
Okay, zones.
The golden rule of coaster safety is that only one train is permitted in a block at any given time.
And sensors on the track take it a step further, right? Constantly updating the computer on exactly where each train is located.
Yes, exactly. If a train tries to cross into a block that is currently occupied by another train, the computer instantly triggers magnetic or friction brakes in the previous block. It physically stops the ride entirely.
Wow.
It removes human error from the equation completely to prevent a rear-end collision.
So once that incredible engineering foundation was rock solid, the amusement park industry did what humans always do. They pushed it to the absolute breaking point.
Of course they did.
They started a fierce, decades-long battle to build the tallest, fastest machines possible.
The Coaster Wars.
The Coaster Wars. The modern era of this arms race really traces its roots back to 1959. That was the year Disneyland introduced the Matterhorn bobsleds.
A classic.
Up until that point, tracks were primarily made of flat steel rails on wooden supports. The Matterhorn introduced the first tubular steel track, which fundamentally changed the geometry of what was possible. Because a steel tube can be bent smoothly in any direction, right? Up, down, left, right, and even twisted around its own axis.
Yes, exactly.
This single breakthrough allowed designers to mathematically calculate and create perfectly smooth loops and corkscrews that those flat wooden tracks would just splinter under.
The wood isn't entirely dead, I should add. There's been a massive resurgence recently with hybrid coasters.
Oh, right.
Companies like Rocky Mountain Construction or RMC have revolutionized the industry by saving rotting wooden roller coasters. They basically perform spinal surgery on the coaster.
That's a great analogy. They strip off the old flat wooden track and replace the fragile wooden vertebrae with a rigid, unbreakable steel backbone.
Exactly. They leave the massive, beautiful wooden support ribs in place, but install their patented steel iBox track on top of it.
And what does that do to the ride experience?
It results in a remarkable smooth ride that suddenly allows these classic wooden structures to twist and turn riders upside down, which, you know, wood could never handle on its own.
So what does this all mean for the scale of modern thrill rides? Like, how high have we actually pushed this tubular steel in the coaster wars?
To map the escalation, the industry had to create entirely new height classifications. It started in 1989 when the Magnum XL 200 created the hypercoaster class, breaking the 200-foot height barrier.
200 feet.
Yep. And then just 11 years later, Millennium Force broke the 300-foot barrier, ushering in the gigacoaster era.
But wait, at 300 feet, you're dealing with immense wind shear. How does the track not just tear itself apart from the lateral aerodynamic forces at the top?
The structural engineering has to adapt dramatically at that height. The support columns are exponentially widened at the base, and the steel itself is designed with slight flexibility.
So it bends.
It actually sways in the wind to dissipate that energy. But going even higher presented a massive mechanical problem. To push from a 300-foot gigacoaster to a 400-foot stratacoaster, traditional chain lifts became utterly useless.
I would assume they'd just be too heavy. You'd need an impossibly massive motor just to pull the weight of a 400-foot steel chain, let alone the actual train filled with people attached to it.
Precisely. To solve that, engineers had to pivot to hydraulic launch systems. To break the 400-foot barrier, rides like Top Thrill Dragster and Kingda Ka used hydraulics.
Oh, Kingda Ka, yeah.
They operate incredibly similarly to an aircraft carrier catapult, just firing the train like a bullet. They launch riders from 0 to 128 miles per hour in 3.5 seconds.
That is insane.
It is, but it generates enough kinetic energy to clear a 45-story tower.
Wow. And for a long time, 456 feet felt like the absolute ceiling. I mean, the mechanical stress and the tens of millions of dollars required seemed to tap out the industry. But we have now officially entered a brand new frontier, the Exacoaster.
The Exacoaster classification. It's for rides breaking the 600-foot barrier.
600 feet.
Yeah, the Falcon's flight coaster in Saudi Arabia, which opened in December 2025, boasts a jaw-dropping 640-foot drop.
Unbelievable.
It doesn't just break previous records, it shatters them by almost 200 feet. And it does this by utilizing natural cliff faces alongside advanced linear synchronous motor launches.
Just wrap your head around that. You are strapped into a bucket seat, held in by polyurethane wheels and a programmable logic controller, and you drop 640 feet. That is literally dropping off the side of a 60-story skyscraper.
It's an unfathomably long way from a block of ice in St. Petersburg.
It really is. The evolution of materials, computer automation, and physics modeling has allowed us to turn what was once a deadly winter pastime into a multi-million dollar feat of precision engineering.
Truly a marvel of modern science.
Well, we've traced the DNA of the thrill ride from 17th century Russia to hauling coal through the mountains of Pennsylvania, all the way to hurtling down a 640-foot tubular steel drop in the desert. The next time you strap into a roller coaster, you're going to experience it completely differently.
Oh, absolutely.
When you hear that ratcheting click, click, click on the lift hill, you'll know it's the anti-rollback dog actively keeping you safe. And when you are pushed down into your seat at the bottom of the drop, you'll know you are physically feeling the exact 4 G's of force that a team of structural engineers carefully calculated to keep your blood exactly where it belongs.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, though, it raises an almost existential question for the industry's future.
Oh, what's that?
The sources mentioned that parks have recently started experimenting with virtual reality headsets on rides.
Right, I've seen those.
When you consider that engineers are now building 600-foot exacoasters, and we are already pushing the absolute maximum 4 to 6 positive G-forces the human body can endure without losing consciousness, it begs the question, have we finally reached the physical limit of the roller coaster?
Wow.
If our biology dictates that we cannot safely build them any taller or launch them any faster without causing mass blackouts, will the future of the thrill ride have to abandon physical height entirely and rely purely on VR to trick our brains into feeling fear?
Now, there is a provocative thought to leave you hanging with. Are we at the absolute physical limit of human adrenaline? Something to think about next time you're waiting in line. Until next time, keep your hands and arms inside the vehicle.